You're listening to the Berkshire Hathaway Annual Shareholders Meeting Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Yahoo Finance.
We had something that not too many countries experience, and if you told people in 1789 that in 72 years you were going to have a division that caused the President of the United States at Gettysburg to say that testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and dedicated can long endure. Imagine the President of the United States wondering aloud whether the country that he was presiding over could long endure only 72 years or 74 years at Gettysburg. Had taken place. So while this marvelous dream was being played out, roughly a third of the way through it, we faced this really moment of decision, and we entered into a contest that, if we'll go to the next slide, made an estimate that literally killed roughly 6% of the males in the country who were between 18 and 60. I'm assuming that there were more than 600,000 deaths in the war. And I think it's a reasonable estimate that 18 to 60 group of males were by far the great proportion. So imagine 6% of your working prime age males in a country are wiped out in 4 years. So when we look at the progress of this country and we think of our own problems now, I just ask you to ponder, and we'll move to the next slide. That would be equivalent today to having 4 billion males in that same age group similarly wiped out. So that was one incredible interruption, which this country nevertheless worked through while compiling this American dream that is one of the wonders of the world, perhaps the wonder of the world in many senses. So let's move on to another crisis of a different sort that hit the country. And this, of course, is the 1929 crash, which led to the Great Depression. And here, the Dow Jones average, which we'll use through this, at that time, that's the one everybody paid attention to, actually the second most important average at that time, if you look at the papers, was the New York Times average, which has disappeared. And of course, the Standard & Poor's has probably regarded this as a superior yardstick. But the Dow Jones is a perfectly adequate yardstick. And on September 3rd, 1929, the Dow Jones average closed at 381.17, and people were very happy, and buying stocks on margin had worked wonderfully in the roaring 20s. Had a good feeling to it with the auto coming of age and the day of air travel coming along and all kinds of new appliances and the telephone getting wider use, believe it or not, but hadn't really caught on that much prior thereto, but the movies were coming on. It was a happy place. And then, of course, if we'll move to the next slide, we'll look at what happened in the couple of months after September 3rd. And the Dow Jones average almost got cut in half. And that was pretty impressive until we had this recent situation where in a shorter period of time, we lost about a third. But the crash, and there's a great book about it called The Great Crash by John Kenneth Galbraith. Let me interject one little plug here. There's a small business in Omaha, and I hate what this, what truncating this meeting or changing it so dramatically has done to many of the businesses in Omaha, because I think small businesses were the beneficiaries of a really, they got a lot of business for the Berkshire meeting, and they're going to get it in the future, but they suffered during a period like this, and they just had a story about the bookworm. Well, the bookworm, if you buy any books that come out of anything I recommend, think about just putting bookworm in Omaha, and The Great Crash is a wonderful book that John Kenneth Galbraith describes it. But I would like to get into a bit of a personal note, which will have some relevance, not too much, but some relevance to the story of the Great Depression. Because in 1929, my dad, who was 26 years of age then, was employed as a security salesman by a local small bank. And he sold stocks and bonds, but he mostly sold stocks. And when stocks fall 48%, and you were selling them to people a few months ago, you really don't feel like going out and facing those same people. So I think my dad probably elected to do, as they say now, shelter in place, which means stay at home. And there really wasn't that much in our house. We just had a small yard. It was wintertime anyway. My dad wouldn't have been puttering on the yard anyway. And there really wasn't, you know, television wasn't there. And he and my mother got along very well. So under those conditions, if you'll turn to the next slide, I was born about 9 months later. So, but at that time, I was actually born on August 30th, but the stock market was closed that day, and so I'm using the previous day's figures. But I didn't notice at the time that the market was closed, but the stock market had actually recovered over 20% during that 9.5 month period or thereabouts. People did not think in the fall of 1930, they did not think they were in a Great Depression. They thought it was a recession very much like had occurred at least a dozen times, although not always when stock markets were important. But we'd had many recessions in the United States over the time, and this did not look like it was something dramatically out of the ordinary. And for a while, actually for about 10 days after my birth, that view held on, and the stock market actually managed to go up all of 1 or 2% there. In those 10 days. But that's the last day. From that point, if you'll turn to the next slide, the stock market went from a level of 240 to 241, which was a noticeable decline because if somebody had given me $1,000 on the day I was born and I'd bought stocks with it and bought the Dow average, my $1,000 would have become $170 in less than 2 years. And that is something that none of us ever experienced, that may have had it with one stock occasionally, but in terms of having a broad range of America marked down 83% in 2 years and marked down 89% of the peak, it was in September 3rd, 1929, was extraordinary. And in that intervening period, less than 1 year after I was born, just slightly less than 1 year, my dad went to the bank where he worked and had his account. And, of course, the bank had a sign on it closed. And so he had no job. And he had two kids at that point. And his father had a grocery store, but Charlie and I both worked for my grandfather. Charlie worked there in 1940. I worked there in 1941, so we didn't know each other. But my grandfather said to my father that, don't worry about your groceries, Howard. He says, I'll just let your bill run. That was my grandfather's, not exactly. He cared about his family, but he wasn't going to go crazy. One of the things as I look back on that period is, and I don't think the economists generally like to give it that much of a point of importance, but if we'd had the FDIC 10 years earlier, the FDIC started on January 1st, 1934. It was part of the sweeping legislation that took place when Roosevelt came in. But if we'd had the FDIC, we would have had a much, much different experience, I believe, in the Great Depression. People blame it on Smoot-Hawley, and there's all kinds of things, and the margin requirements in 29, and all of those things entered into creating a recession. But if you have over 4,000 banks fail, that's 4,000 local experiences where people save and save and save and put their money away, and then someday they reach for it and it's gone. And that happens, you know, in all 48 states, and it happens to your neighbors, and it happens to your relatives. It has to have an effect on the psyche that's incredible. So one very, very, very good thing that came out of the Depression, in my view, is the FDIC, and it would have been a somewhat different world, I'm sure, if the bank failures hadn't just rolled across this country and with people that thought that they were savers found out that they had nothing when they went there, and there was a sign that said closed. Incidentally, the FDIC, I think very few people know this, but or at least they don't appreciate it, but the FDIC has not cost the American taxpayer a dime. I mean, its expenses have been paid, its losses have been paid, all through assessments on banks. It's been a mutual insurance company of the banks, backed by the federal government and associated with the federal government. But now it holds $100 billion, and that consists of premiums that were paid in and investment income on the premiums, less the expenses and paying of all the losses. And think of the incredible amount of peace of mind that's given to people that were not similarly situated in when the Great Depression hit. So the Great Depression went on, and it lasted a very long time, but it lasted a lot longer in the minds of people than it did actually in its effects. World War II came along, and on sort of an involuntary manner, we adopted Keynesianism. We started running fiscal deficits, of course, that were absolutely huge, and took our debt up to a percentage of GDP, which we've never reached, had never reached before, and never reached since. So we had an enormous economic recovery, but the minds of people had been so scarred, the memories. Parents told their children, 1929 became a symbol in people's minds. I mean, if you said 1929, it was like saying 1776 or 1492. I mean, everybody knew exactly what you were talking about. And it affected stock prices in a rather remarkable way, to the point, if you'll change to the next slide, it was January 4th of 1951 that the kid who was born on August 30th in 1930 had finished college before the stock market got back to where it was at that earlier time. So take the years from 1951, or take the year from my birth, 20 years, and bear in mind that, you know, the country was only 140 years old when this started. That's 20 years out of this amazing 231-year lifetime of our country that was flat out, you know, a time of, for a long time, of no economic growth and no feeling by people in terms about the wealth of the country, about what American economy was worth, what all these corporations that were doing far, far, far better than they were long ago. But it took all of that time to restore in the market a price level that was equal to what it was when I was born 20 years earlier. So if you think about the fact that we're enduring a few months, and we'll endure some many more months, but and we don't know how it comes out. And people in the 30s didn't know how it was going to come out, but they endured, persevered, prospered, and the American miracle continued. But it's interesting in that I actually don't have a slide for the next one, because last night I was thinking, after all the slides had been prepared, I was actually thinking about this a little bit, and I remembered that at the start of 1954, the stock market was, the Dow was only at about 280. And I remember 1954 because it was the best year I ever had in the stock market. And the Dow went from essentially, 280 or thereabouts at the start of the year to a little over 400 at the end of the year. And when it went to 400, as soon as it went across 381, that famous figure from 1929, when it went to 400, and this will be hard for some of you to believe, but everybody wondered, is this 1929 all over again? And that seems a little far-fetched, because it was a different country in 1954. But that was the common question, and it actually achieved, it achieved such a level of worry about whether we were about to jump off another cliff, just because the 381 of 1929 had been exceeded, that they held Senator Fulbright, Bill Fulbright of Arkansas, who became very famous later in terms of the Foreign Relations Committee, but he headed the Senate Banking Committee, and he called a special, for a special investigation And he called it the stock market study. But it really, if you read through it, he really was questioning whether we had built another house of cards again. And on his committee, it's interesting to see the Senate Finance Committee, one of the members was Prescott Bush, the father of George H.W. Bush, grandfather of George W. Bush, and had some illustrious names. And his committee, in March of 1955, with the Dow at 405, assembled 20 of the best minds in the United States to testify as to whether we were going crazy again, because the market was at 400, the Dow was at 400, and we'd gotten in this incredible trouble before. But that was the mindset of the country. It's incredible. We didn't really believe America was what it was. And my boss, the reason I'm familiar with this 1,000-page book that I have here, I found it last night in the library and everything, was that I was working in New York for one of the 20 people that was called down to testify before Senator Fulbright. And he testified right before Bill Martin, who was running the Federal Reserve, testified, and right after General Wood, who was running Sears, testified. Sears was very, very important then. And Bill Martin, of course, is the fellow that longest running chairman in the history of the Fed, and he's the one that gave the famous quote about the function of the Fed was to take away the punch bowl just when the party started to get really warmed up. But Ben Graham, my boss, sent me over to the public library in New York and to gather some information for him, something you could do in 5 minutes with a computer now, and I dug out something, and he went to testify. And on page 545 of this book, I knew where to look. I didn't have to go through it all, but he had the quote, which I remember. And I remember because Ben Graham was one of the three smartest people I've met in my life. And he was the dean of people in securities business. He wrote the classic security analysis book in 1934. He wrote the book that changed my life, The Intelligent Investor, in 1949. He was unbelievably smart. And when he testified, the Dow at 404, he had one line in there right toward the start in his written testimony, and he said, the stock market is high, looks high, it is high, but it's not as high as it looks. But he said, it is high. And since that time, if we'll turn to the next slide, of course, we felt the American tailwind at full force, and the Dow... Well, let's see. And the Dow went down Friday, but when we made the slide, it was about 24,000. So you're looking at a market today that has produced $100 for every dollar. All you did was had to believe in America and just buy a cross section of America. You didn't have to read the Wall Street Journal. You didn't have to look up the price of your stock. You didn't have to pay a lot of money in fees to anybody. You just had to believe that the American miracle was intact. But you'd had this testing period between 1929 and certainly 1954, as indicated by what happened when it got back up to 380. You had this testing period, and people really, they'd lost faith to some degree. They just didn't see the potential of what America could do. And we found that nothing can stop America when you get right down to it. And it's been true all along. It may have been interrupted with the scariest of scenarios when you had a war with one group of states fighting another group of states. And it may have been tested again in the Great Depression, and it may be tested now to some degree. But in the end, the answer is never bet against America. And that, in my view, is as true today as it was in 1789, and even was true at the during the Civil War and the depths of the Depression. Now, I'm now about to say something and don't change the slide yet, but some of you will be tempted to argue with me about, but I would make the case that we are imperfect in a great, great, great many ways, but I would say, and if you'll put up the next slide, that we are now a better country, as well as an incredibly more wealthy country than we were in 1789. We're far, far, far from what we should be, will be, but we have gone dramatically in the right direction. It's interesting. We said in 1776, he said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And yet, 14 years later, a year after we really officially began the country in 1789, adopted a constitution, we found that more than 15% of the people in the country were slaves. And we wrestled with that. But when you say the word self-evident, that sort of sounds like you're saying any damn fool can recognize that. And you certainly say, you can argue maybe a little bit about life and pursuit of happiness, but I don't see how in the world anybody can reconcile liberty with the idea that 15% of the population was enslaved. And it took us a long time to at least partially correct that dichotomy. It took a civil war. It took losing 6% of those people. That the males that were between 18 and 60 years of age took. But we've moved in the right direction. We've got a long ways to go, but we've moved in the right direction now. In addition, going back again to that 1776 statement, that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator, et cetera, I think it was self-evident to the 50% of the population that they were getting a fair deal for over half the lifetime of the country. It took 131 years of our country's 231 years. It took 131 years until women were guaranteed the right to vote for our country's leaders. And then what's even more remarkable is that after we adopted the 19th Amendment, 1920, it took 61 more years until a woman was allowed to join.
Thanks for listening to this section of the Berkshire Hathaway's annual Shareholders Meeting podcast. The next section can be found in the next episode in your podcast feed. So please go check it out. If you enjoy this podcast, leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts.